Accession number 33202, reel 7.
Terry Light, reel 7. So you're in the tower, you're getting reports from everything else that's going on around you.
Yeah.
So what happens? Is that the pattern for that day?
That's the pattern for the first day, yes. And then all I remember is that the order came after the first day that we should, I don't know whether everybody did, in tactical headquarters, move out into some buildings near the town. And so we moved down the road into some buildings, and we were under the command of the regimental sergeant major at this stage. Or we seemed to be under his command. And we set up night positions in these derelict flats.
And how did you do that? What does that involve?
That involved really setting up sentry posts and observation posts. Now, one of the tasks of an I section is also OPs, observation posts out in the field. And so I remember I was on the, not on the, they were flat topped, but I was on the next floor down and had an observation post there looking out towards Portside. And the task of four of us, had three with me then, three privates, was to rotate, keeping a constant observation really, which from that eye point down the roads it towards Portside, and report if anything was started moving up towards us. And then every now and again the RSM would pop his head round the door and say, you know, ask us, is everything all right, everything quiet? And it was, except for the popping of small arms ammunition, everything was as quiet as a dormouse that first night. And as far, I don't know how the rifle companies were coping, but I am not aware of any major activity during that the first night on Egyptian soil. And then, of course, the big excitement at dawn was the seaboard invasion. 40 commando with support coming in landing craft, and with them at the same time helicopters, and I think also two para. They came in, we saw them coming in, they would be around the corner slightly there, coming in waves, slightly down on the beaches, again towards Portside. And then day two was interesting because we, for a time, we stayed up in our little eyrie, watching things going on. But I mentioned to you earlier on that there was this threat of self-propelled guns, which the Egyptians had. And the military dealt with that situation, not so much with the anti-tank guns, although I'm sure the anti-tank guns proved indispensable, but Fleet Air Arm had two basic aircraft for ground support. One was the one I've mentioned earlier on, was the Vampire, the Sea Vampire, and the other one was the Wyvern, which is a fighter bomber, a dive bomber. The nearest I can think of being the German Stuka during World War II. And artillery observation officers had the task of not only spotting artillery emplacements to get them knocked out, but also to spot where these SU, I forget the number, self-propelled tanks anyway, self-propelled guns, where they were operating. And of course they weren't daft, they were operating in the buildings, around the buildings, and hiding in the buildings on the outskirts of Portside. So, from what I heard, and by now I'd come downstairs, and TAC HQ had moved out to us en masse, you could hear that an AOP would report that a self-propelled tank had been spotted on such and such a map reference, grid reference, and would it be dealt with immediately by the Fleet Air Arm. Now, up above, all the time, you would have this taxi of Wyvern dive bombers just circling. and making this characteristic noise of, they've got two propellers contra-rotating. It wasn't a jet, two propellers, and it was a very distinctive noise. And you'd hear them humming around up there, I don't know, a couple of thousand feet up. And then you'd look up, and suddenly the noise would change, the engine noise would change, and he would put it in into a dive, this fleet air arm pilot, and he'd come down almost vertical. It was really impressive to watch. And he'd come down almost vertical with this distinctive screaming engine, and then you'd think, God almighty, he is going to crash. And then he'd suddenly pull out, and he'd pull out and start to go up, and the bomb would come down, continue down, and presumably hit the hidden target, or the observable target of a self-propelled gun. So that's how they cancelled out the advantage of the self-propelled guns over our lightly armed troops. The other threat, which I certainly didn't know about, but I didn't find out until we got into the port itself, were that the Egyptian army had these mobile rocket launchers mounted on the wagons, so that you'd have this battery of rockets which could be fired, and then the driver would get the hell out of it, move on, hide, before anybody up above or on the ground could spot where the rocket had come from. Now, I am not sure, you'd have to talk to some of my colleagues, whether they actually came under rocket fire, I just don't know. But I never saw any. I only saw the remnants of them when I got into Portside, and we saw all the ordnance, the hardware, which had been thrown away, surrendered, whatever you want to call it. Mountains of it, heaps of it. So how did we spend the second day? I think it was Sparvo who would have told me to do this. Take a patrol out and look at those flats over there. In other words, we'd moved in towards the town, and I took a couple of lads with me, and we really told to find out, you know, is there anybody in those flats? So really we wandered across there. The flats were completely deserted, windows blown out, blinds flapping in the wind, flies everywhere. And I suppose there are two things that I remember from now on while I was on Egyptian soil, and that is the smell and flies. Bearing in mind this is November, still quite hot during the day, but the flies, big black flies, were slowing down. In other words, they were more mobile and really hot weather, so that if a fly landed on you could always swat it. I would think in midsummer when it was belting really hot, they would be too quick for you to swat them. But there were flies, and of course the situation would be aggravated by the detritus which would have been in and around Portside at that particular time, and the flies thriving on it. The other smell would have been burning material, and perhaps, I don't know, I couldn't distinguish bodies, for all I know. So we nosed around these flats. I took photographs. I've still got some of the photographs, black and white photographs.
What sort of things were you looking for?
Well, first of all, we were looking to see if there was any Egyptians there, civilian or otherwise. We didn't find any. Otherwise, to identify any Egyptian equipment that had been abandoned. And you find the usual selection of Czechoslovakian small arms thrown away. The biggest thing we all found, I've got a photograph of it, is a self-propelled gun partially buried in mud with the hatch open. I suspect, I don't think it had been hit, I'm certain it hadn't been hit by any ordnance, but I suspect it had driven down into this call it a sandy track, if you like, on the outskirts of the shanty town, and it had been too heavy and had semi-buried itself in the sand, and therefore the crew had abandoned the place, so the gun was really pointing down at the sand instead of being dangerously pointing up where it should be. So I was really making a note of things like that, and then before dusk, reporting back to TAC HQ.
Did you bring back any souvenirs?
I brought back an Egyptian flag, which eventually was painted with three para. Compass, which was a Russian compass. A pipe bomb, which I still got. I use as a paperweight. I think that was about my lot. Some of them, daft beggars that they were, they tried to take as souvenirs Mausers, Czechoslovakian or Russian built weapons, and tried to bring them back to Cyprus. But that's, I'll come on to that in a moment. But I didn't fancy any of that at all. No. Just a few souvenirs. So after that, I think the ceasefire was declared when Brigadier Butler, and his entourage were supposedly racing down the canal to try and eventually get to Ismailia. But the ceasefire was declared, as you're aware, under pressure from the United States of America, threatening to destroy the economy of the United Kingdom, oil embargo, and then everything else that John Foster Dulles could think of in his brinkmanship. So much for the special relationship. So hostilities ceased.
And when did you hear about that?
Third day, perhaps.
And were you still in the same place? Were you still?
No, I'm in Portside by now. What happened was we went through the flats. The flats were empty, discarded, in a hell of a state. And then it was the shanty town. As far as I'm concerned, we quickly walked through the shanty town. I didn't want to get involved in that at all. None of us wanted to get involved at all in that.
In what? In what?
In the shanty town. That was a rabbit warren of slums. Shanty, you know, self-built, corrugated huts, you call it that, if you can call it that, with virtual no sanitation, open sewers, disgusting place to live in. And so we eventually got into the outskirts of Portside, and by then the seaborne invasion had taken roots and settled in, so you had tank regiment there with their tanks, Centurion tanks, and you had the Marines, you had infantry of the line regiments, I think the West Kents were there, and that was where an officer of the West Kents, I think it was the West Kents, foolishly wandered into the slums of Shantytown. I think he was kidnapped and shot, other than that, there's nothing. The only thing I can really remember while we were waiting for embarkation, the order came that hostilities had ceased, and Butler and his brigade headquarters had now had to move back up towards Portside. The French were doing their own thing over the other side of the canal. We were told to wait, and we would be. We would embark upon the, I am certain it is the troop ship, or what was a passenger ship, the SS Australia. Can you confirm that?
Yes, I have been. Other people have mentioned the Australia.
There's a bit of. We talked about this once, at a reunion once. Some people maintained it wasn't the SS Australia, but I'm pretty certain it was.
And just take me back a bit to just how you heard that that a ceasefire had been declared.
Can't remember.
Well, but can you remember what the response was to the ceasefire?
Oh. Why do it now? Because we're, you know, we've done what we set out to do. The task of Three Power was to seize El Gamo Airport and then penetrate as far as possible into Port Said without getting involved in the seaborne landings, which came in 24 hours lately. In other words, you didn't want to be tuned up with friendly fire from Marines or other seaborne troops. That was the danger, especially in darkness. So that was the task, and it succeeded in that task. So as far as, I suppose, an element of relief, but having done all this and got ourselves all keyed up in the adrenaline, what an anticlimax. You know, we're going back to Cyprus. So what? Oh God, back to EOCA duties and the boredom that could be for some people.
And how long did you... do you have any sense of how long you waited in Port Said before you...
No idea. Can't remember. I think it was daylight hours, as I remember it. Really killing time around the docks until this damn great big two-funnelled liner appeared, and then we were taken out by tender to the SS Australia and allocated cabins, which none of us occupied because it was too damn hot. And so everybody found themselves, regardless of your rank, you found yourself a suitable, comfortable space on the open deck somewhere and killed time between meals. And then eventually this troop ship sailed back to Famagusta in Cyprus, and then we arrived in darkness at Famagusta, after dark, anyway, and the dockside was floodlit, and you looked over the side, and what did you see below on the dockyard? The place was zooming, buzzing with military police. And the reason being that the authorities had heard that these damn paratroopers were coming back to Cyprus with souvenirs such as small arms, ammunition and weapons, which could be brought onto the island and get into the wrong hands, i.e. EOCA terrorists. It caused an almighty rumpus because you know, the conquering heroes coming home and having to be searched by military police, who we hate in any case. We've always hated and always will hate. In fact, the rest of the British Army hate the military police. Bless them. But the amusing thing was that you could look over one side of where the ship was docked in darkness, and all these arc lights everywhere, and the gangplanks out, and filing off, and being searched, taken into sheds and searched, and then onto transports to be taken back to Pegasus Camp. If you should happen to go to the other side, the seaward side, you'd hear little splashes all the way along. Because once the word had got around that the military police were searching everybody, everybody was throwing away their small arms, their Egyptian weapons or Czechoslovakian weapons or knives or ammunition, souvenirs going over the side. So somewhere in the port of Famagusta, there down in the mud, there must be a lot of small arms stuff.
How did you get away with your pipe bomb?
I don't know, to be honest. But I had everything in a rucksack. I had my pouches here, or pouches there, actually. You wore your pouches on, or I did, most of us, wore our pouches hanging down from our waist, not from our straps. And that pipe bomb was down there somewhere. I don't know, but I've still got it. I can show you. I got through with it. I must have looked an honest person when they searched me, that's all I can think of. But we were taken by transport back to Camp Pegasus. I suppose we got back there, I don't know, it was daybreak or what, I think it was light, I can't remember. And of course there we were met by the miserable devils of the rear guard party, because obviously to keep the camp ticking over in our absence, somebody had to stay behind to guard the blessed place inside. And so there was the people who had the boring job of not having the kudos and the excitement of taking part in the this mass parachute drop, but they'd had to stay behind and virtually nothing, an empty camp, and now with all these mad fools coming back shouting and abusing them for just being the poor saps who'd been nominated to be the rear guard. And thank goodness I wasn't a rear guard. I tell you again, if they wanted to make use of me as a national serviceman, they could have put me on the rear guard and I'd have missed all that. Now, my understanding of that parachute drop is that it is the largest mass drop since World War II, as I understand it. I don't know if anybody else has said that, but that's my understanding. There hasn't been that number thrown out of a plane since then, and I very much doubt if there will be. And one of the requirements of any mass parachute drop, other than the obvious of having the planes and the men to do it, is that there must be air supremacy. And of course the RAF had air supremacy over Egyptian waters and Egyptian land at that particular time. Otherwise it wouldn't have gone ahead. Now it's also assumed, I suppose, by many people, perhaps talking to some of the people you've spoken to already, that it was an Anglo-French skirmish war incident. But of course we forget the Israelis, because whilst the French paras landed on Port Fouad, the eastern side of the canal, we landed on the west side. Of course the Israelis were racing across Sinai towards the canal, so they were the third party of that particular war. So we came back into the mundane routine of eventually of Camp Pegasus, and that really we were put back onto IOCA duties.
And did you have any sense of how Sirius was being received back at home?
I used to get letters from Olga. I used to get letters from my parents, and we used to get the what we call air editions of the newspapers, such as the Telegraph, which was a very lightweight paper. In fact, you could hold it up and you could see the writing on the other side, the print on the other side. I used to have some examples of that. And they used to be flown out. We used to, while we were in camp, we used to get those the day after. So when we came back, we were aware of events by picking up on what had been delivered into Camp Pegasus, and you could read these, the Daily Telegraph or whatever it is you took your fancy of newspapers at that particular time. So then, you know, you could catch up on the world news, as you might say.
And was the reaction positive, negative?
Well, I think in general terms it was a military action which was successful, but as a political and economic incident, it was a total disaster for the French and the British. Absolute disaster. As you know, Premier Eden was a sick man. His cabinet was split down the middle. There was a lot of anti-war feeling in the UK, but Eden went ahead blindly in collaboration with his opposite number in France, and also in collaboration with Israel. Americans had an election coming up, Eisenhower, and I think it was just after the Suez shambles, that is shambles in terms of economics and politics, I think it was just after then that Eisenhower was re-elected for a second term as President of the United States. And so when you look at it in hindsight, perhaps Eisenhower and his partner in crime, John Foster Dulles, Mr. Brinkman's ship, and bearing in mind they were looking at the scene with Khrushchev rattling the sabre over the Hungarian uprising, which was taking place at the same time, and also dominating the headlines. You put all those together, I suppose to a certain degree he wanted to be re-elected, and he was looking at it and when I mean he, I mean Eisenhower, he was looking at it from a American perspective, worldwide, being afraid of USSR, whereas Eden, well, he was looking at it as a from the point of view of just being Premier of the United Kingdom and the Commonwealth, a Commonwealth which was, or an empire which was dying or dead. And as one person, I don't know who said it, the Suez incident was the last fling of two imperialist nations, i.e. UK and France. And I think that sums it up. After that, well, yoga activities.
So, and what were you doing? Were you doing your? You were still in the role of setting up tactical HQs.
Tactical HQ, maps, photographs, training, new intake in the standards of map reading, compass work, which was expected. Because all right, they would have done that in basic training, recruit training. But the attitude of the CEO was, quite rightly, I think, was that perhaps that wasn't sufficient for the standards which Three Para demanded. And so we had to take them through that instruction. And we did the same, or I did the same, a group of us did the same when we came back to Blighty. And I suppose I saw my last months out in Aldershot, back in Corona Barracks.
So whenabouts was that? When did you come back?
Now, this is where I stand corrected by some of my colleagues or what you've already heard. It was either pre or post Christmas. I can't remember whether I was home at Christmas or not.
Okay.
And Olga doesn't remember.
So either December 56 or January 57?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I would have, we would have been sent on leave on coming back. And I would have spent my time doing what I've just told you, and also on exercises. Now, I'll bring you up to date. I'll jump now, really, because it was mundane stuff, boring stuff in Aldershot.
Would you want to just tell me about the exercises? What exercise? Can you remember?
Well, you'd go on exercises on Salisbury Plain. In other words, the army, the authorities couldn't spend the time, or they didn't have the aircraft, so they couldn't do a parachute drop onto a DJ zone on Salisbury Plain. So you would go there by lorry transport, and you would simulate a drop. In other words, you would jump off haphazard over the DZ as if you'd just come down from above, right? And then the objective would be to hold the DZ against the enemy, whoever they were be. That would be the, normally the enemy on Salisbury Plain would be the coming out of the infantry school at Warminster. They would be the enemy. You would then capture, secure the DZ for reinforcements, and then you would go on a force march. Always remember, when the last exercises I did on Salisbury Plain, this would have been about April, maybe May. It was a night march, a force march from the DZ area on the western edge of Salisbury Plain. Salisbury Plain, by the way, is about the size of the Isle of Wight in hectareage. And we had to go on a force march and capture the heights above Westbury. You know the town of Westbury, which is on the northwest side of Salisbury Plain. White Horse and all that nonsense, just above it. The I section, for reasons which I don't understand, were nominated to lay out the markers of this forced night march. And the markers being, you'd unroll tape, so that the assault companies could follow up, following the tapes, to where the final assault, the big deal, would take place.